For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. I'm Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and we have Eric Diamond with us today. He's CEO of PushSend. He's here to tell us about his product, his company. I myself am anxiously awaiting, because he's come up with what I consider something of really great value to our audience. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first, Eric, tell us a little bit about yourself, then about your company, and then about your product.
Sure. So I have been in the digital marketing technology space for over 20 years at this point. I started a company by the name of Tribeca Digital about 10 years ago, which is more of like a digital agency servicing big brands such as Sesame Street and Wyndham Hotels and other startups, if you will. We have always maintained to be an SMB ourselves. We didn't really grow tremendously purposely. We stayed that way. And prior to that, I was head of technology for all of New York for Turner Broadcasting, and was the CTO for a short period of time for Time Out Publications, which I was part of the team that got them sold to a company out of London.
Well, that's a pretty impressive background. Now, your new company is PushSend. What's it all about?
Yes. So PushSend simply is an all-in-one marketing tool that allows for SMBs to easily create, market, and manage all of their email campaigns, their landing pages, and their events for event marketing. So ultimately, we as a small business was looking for tools ourselves that can do all of these things as an all-in-one platform. And so we started building it for ourselves and had gone into the market to some associates, other SMBs, and they were giving us some great feedback on the product. So we decided at a certain point that we were going to share it with the world and basically launch it. So this product ultimately allows for SMBs to scale. It's easy enough, simple enough for these SMBs to use, but sophisticated enough to grow with them. So everything, as I mentioned, from doing their email campaigns and automation for emails and things along those lines, all the way through to building out landing pages for products and services that they need for those email campaigns to convert, whether it be subscribers or users. And then we also have an event management piece that allows for them to create event registrations and pages and things along those lines.
Well, and your website?
The website is pushsend.com. So currently we have a coming soon page up. We're going to be launching at the end of this month, which we're very excited about, to the public. And we have one of the only services that's out there, I should say, one of the few services that has what we call a free forever tier, which essentially allows for users to come in. Especially if you're at the very low end of a small business, or you're just starting out as a startup, you have the ability to use the product for as long as you want and try it out so that we can prove and show our value to what we bring to market.
Okay, Eric, my first question, this is radio. Spell out your website for people.
Sure. It's push, P-U-S-H, send, S-E-N-D.com. PushSend.com.
Okay, I have a lot of questions for you, because email marketing has always been a bugaboo for me, because I've been doing it for years, and people say, first I'm going to say, people are saying email marketing is dead. What do you say to that?
I say that the statistics show otherwise. I think that it is the most highly converting form of marketing, especially for SMBs these days in such a competitive landscape. It's just a function of, you know, are you utilizing the right tools, the right designs, the right conversion mechanisms so that you can get your messaging out there? We like to say that we help these SMBs to tell and sell their story, right? So, because every SMB has products and services that they want to get out there, email marketing is one of, if not the highest converting, you know, areas in marketing today.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, Eric, because the first thing is everybody talks about all of these new rules of spamming, et cetera. How does your system help people avoid getting charged with this and all that other stuff that happens? Okay.
So that's a great question. And so the answer to that is that we have, so first of all, spam and all that stuff comes from having, for example, when you send out emails and you have users that use Gmail or other types of user accounts, a lot of times, depending on how much email you're sending them, it will automatically go to their spam folders and things along those lines. We have mechanisms in place that are part of our platform and system that will give you scoring and rate you based on whether or not you are sending too many emails or things along those lines. We also have what's called for authority. We have very, you know, relationships with the ISPs that are out there, Google on down, that know that they're going to be sending from our IP addresses, so that we give certain reputation and authority so that they know more so than the next guy not to necessarily call it spam. We also have, when we've been spending a lot of time on something called GDPR, which is more European for European customers, even as small business, where we are abiding by all of the data privacy laws and all of those things that come into play with Europe. And we've been doing so and for months now, getting that in place so that we comply and make sure that all the spam laws and data privacy laws are up to, you know, we're up to all the latest and greatest.
Okay. You know, everybody talks about the spam and all of these problems. Eric, how does your system address these issues?
Right. So with spam, we care very much. I mean, everything is about reputation. Everything is about, you know, the authority and making sure that your emails can be delivered as to a high degree as possible. Within our system, we've spent a huge amount of time establishing relationships with the ISPs like the Googles on down, letting them know that we are a new provider. We also have IP addresses that are what we call very, very clean and solid and have a very good reputation for folks. We have tools that allow for users to know whether or not certain pieces of their email are being considered spam, and we score and rate them. And even for our own systems, because we don't want to ruin it for any of the other customers, any violators of our terms of service against spam laws, we very diligently go after and make sure that they're complying. And if not, then certainly we would terminate them from the service. But we will help as much as possible if certain customers are getting a lot of spam or spamming a lot and being deemed to be spam. The other side of it is we have GDPR compliance, which is a European data privacy law, which complies with, which is also talks about the whole spam side of things. And you know, we have been spending months complying with all the laws, and we're happy to say that we're now in compliance, and we're, you know, for launch, we'll have everything in place.
Okay. Well, see, Eric, you're talking to somebody that's had 20 years experience with email, and I can tell you, it has been an absolute bear for me over those 20 years. I have a database of over now over 3 million small business readers that I've acquired over the years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, every time I send out the list, there's always one or two people who say, oops. Instead of just saying they don't want it anymore, they complain. And it's just, and then you go to the constant contacts of this world, and they sit there and say, it's your fault, and bingo, you're out. How do you handle a situation like that, Eric?
Right. So to us, first of all, that talks more to a deep-rooted question, which is about customer service and supporting our customers. For us, first of all, let me just say, it is absolutely vital to us that our customers perceive our service from a value perspective to be always greater than the actual value of the what they're actually paying for of the service. And what I mean by that is that it comes down to customer support. So in a situation like that, where a customer would, you know, respond or come at us and say that they're getting complaints or whatever, we absolutely will work with them. This is not a, for us, we're not looking to throw customers out the window. We're looking to sit down, work out the situation, make sure that they can get on track. Remember, our company, all the people involved have come from professional services, so we're used to working with teams. It's not just some system where you're not talking to anybody. We offer, even in our free tier, the ability to chat with us. So if you're having problems, we're there to hold your hand and make sure that we can help you work through the problem.
Well, that is music to my ears, because it has, in the past, I have found that working with people like Constant Contact is like pulling teeth.
yeah.
Okay.
This is why they're losing a lot of market share.
Yes. I will not recommend them.
I'm sorry?
To my audience. But let's go on, because, Eric, you're definitely talking music to my ears. So how do you charge?
So the way that we work is it's very straightforward. We have, as I mentioned to you, the free tier, and then we have two paid tiers. The paid tier, we have a very low cost of entry for a certain number of contacts, and then from there it scales up. You can buy more contacts, and you get a certain amount of things for that particular tier. We have, it's called Newbie and then Pro. Newbie, of course, out of the gate, if you want to get away from the free tier, in the free tier we offer about 500 contacts for you to just try it out and a certain number of sends. And you can use that forever if you only have a few contacts that you send emails to, or you can use it as your trial, but as long as you want, if you will. And in Newbie, you just pay per contacts, and then sends are unlimited. And ultimately, there's a certain number of landing pages and a certain number of what we call lead gen forms that you can generate. And then Pro is pretty much unlimited everything. So when you scale your business and you need more things and more sophisticated tools, we have a bunch of differentiators between the Newbie and Pro.
Okay. Well, let's say you have 100,000 names. What would that cost you?
For 100,000 names, roughly, is probably around the area of $200, I'd say, something like that, a month.
A month?
Yes, correct.
Is that unlimited selling, sending, or is it one or two sendings? Or what would
it be? So the way that it works is it's unlimited sends per month, up to 50,000 sends per month. And then ultimately, beyond there, you get charged per send, which is very, 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 you know, minuscule.
Mm. Sounds interesting. Now tell us, how it works. You know, I have a newsletter I want to put out, and inside
sure.
that newsletter, I have the ability to offer my clients of the 10% off on my widgets. How does that work, and how do you help me put that all together?
Sure. So the way that we work is we built these tools for ourselves, so we want it simple yet powerful. And the way that this is, so you come in, you very easily, you see and choose something that says create a campaign. Now, we have very unique aspects of our system. So, for example, when you come in and create a campaign, you have a couple of different types of campaigns you can create. You have a regular campaign, which is just a regular email. You have one that's called a sequential email, which essentially allows for you to create multiple emails that are, you know, based on date, if you will, that they all complement each other. Or you have one that's called multivariate. And ultimately, that's a test that allows for you to put together. So you can do, for example, like A-B testing of your subject line or your body of your email. And then you choose a certain amount of percentage that goes out to. And then the winner of that would go out to the rest of your audience. And then we tell you which one won and so on and so forth. So when you choose, let's just say a standard email, let's just use that, you come in, you can choose a template. We have over 100 templates that you can choose from in different categories right off the bat, so you can have really great looking, you know, emails, if you will, or create one from scratch using a very, very robust yet easy to use drag and drop editor. And so our goal has always been, you know, how do we make you look like a rock star? How do we make you look like you put a professional email together and you're not a professional designer, right?
Mm-hmm. So are you offering beta to people at this point?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So come the next week or two, we're going to be asking folks to write into us to be part of our beta program. Before we do launch, we'd love to get feedback from folks.
Well, you know, I'm going to be one of your first beta people.
Okay.
No, your system sounds so great. Your website again, Eric?
I'm sorry?
Your website for people?
Oh, yes. It's PushSend, PushSend, PushSend.com.
It just sounds fascinating. Now, let's go a little further. You do a multivariate. It indicates that the test 3 is the one that's going to go with. Now, do you have tools then to help people understand the results of the test going forward?
Absolutely. So we do. We pride ourselves in all the analytics and the details. So everything about us is about analytics. So whether it be a landing page, an email campaign, or an event, we have analytics that wraps around all of this stuff.
Well, do you help people put things on their web on their landing page that helps them better understand what's going on?
So one of the interesting, unique features that we offer in the pro version, for example, is the ability to we give you a marketing consultant. So you literally get 2 hours a month that you can consult. And the whole point of it is that that person can help you, whether it be with, you know, coming up with conversion areas, whether it be design, whether it be marketing related questions, anything around those areas, they can help help you convert more, if you will.
Wow. But now you have 3 versions, if I heard you. One version is free, one is a little bit more, and can you go and discuss those 3 tiers again?
Sure, absolutely. So we have the free tier, which, of course, again, is free. And ultimately, you can start out. You get 500 contacts and up to 1,500 sends that you can send on that. And you have the newbie tier, which starts out at ultimately at $25 for up to 1,500 contacts and unlimited sends. up to, and we say unlimited, we say up to 50,000 sends, and then we start charging. And then you can, right then and there, you can upgrade your contacts. Of course, they cost more, but you can continuously add contacts if you'd like into the system. And then Pro starts at $169 a month, and that gives you over, well, you know, 10,000 contacts to start with, unlimited of everything else, whether it be landing pages, sends, land, you know, lead gen forms, all of that stuff.
Uh-huh. Okay.
As well, well as what event you... marketing.
Okay, so once you hit that 10,000 mark, mm-hmm. let's say you go to 20,000. How much extra per record is it?
So as you to go to 20,000, hold on 1 second. So in order for you, so for you to go into, where is it? Yeah, I'm sorry. 1 second. Okay. Sorry. So from you to go from 10,000, you know, the way that it works is it'll go from 10 to 12,000. Is $179. It kind of jumps up in groups of $10.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yep. And then as you get more and more and down the line, it kind of starts to jump in the areas of more of like $20. As you get to the 40, 50,000, 60,000 range, and it jumps every $20 or so.
Hmm. No, it just sounds fascinating. And as I said, Eric, I intend to be one of your beta people and bring in some of mine just to see how it works. Because
I appreciate that.
Email, people say it's dying. Other people say it's still a very effective tool. You're betting your company on it that it is an effective tool. And you're going down to the almost the lowest, the corner drugstore almost, it seems.
Absolutely. We believe our tools can address the SMB market and can grow upwards. We have sophisticated enough tools to help and be with that SMB through the life, their entire life, growing into maturity and all the different levels of tools that they'll need for their marketing.
Hmm. It really sounds fascinating. So tell us, we have just a couple of minutes left. Tell us what your future plans are.
So, like I said, we're going to be launching in the end of this month. And then, you know, it's really about just making sure that every piece of our platform, whether it be email campaigns, landing pages, or events, are all equally as great and working well for our users. We plan on building out for the future much more robust event marketing pieces to the platform, which is going to include ticketing and a lot of other areas. So our game plan is to have an all-in-one platform so that if you are looking for a marketing, you know, you can come to PushSend and ultimately you'll find some means for you to do your marketing, whether it be text messaging, which is something we're looking into for the future as well, text marketing. And yeah, so that's what we're doing.
Okay. Eric, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. One more time for our audience, your website.
Sure, it's pushsend.com, pushsend.com.
Eric Diamond, thank you so much. And
thank you.
A link to that website will be on our on a Small Business Digest website tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss, who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone. And my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. This is Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and the guest today is Alexandria Ravenel. Alexandria, I love that name. Welcome to the program. What a beautiful name.
Thank you. My mother will be thrilled to hear that. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm going to say without ado, tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, sure. So I am an assistant professor at Mercy College here in New York, and I'm also a visiting scholar at the Institute for Public Institute for Public Knowledge here at New York University, and I am the author of the book that is coming out next week, Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy, which is based on the interviews with nearly 80 workers for Airbnb, Uber, TaskRabbit, and Kitchen Surfing, which was a rent-a-chef service, and about workers' experiences working behind closed doors in the peer-to-peer component of the sharing economy.
Wow. And your website and how people can get the book?
Sure. So my website is alexandriajravenel.com. So that's A-L-E-X-A-N-D-R-E-A, the letter J, Ravenel, R-A-V as in Victor, ENELLE.com. And the website is available on Amazon, and the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and of course at the University of California Press website.
Well, my first question is, what made you suddenly decide to do this? It's a book that I think is necessary, but tell us more.
Sure. So I actually had a small consulting business doing marketing communications for nonprofits, and I was teaching for a number of colleges as an adjunct instructor. And one day, I was regularly hiring TaskRabbits to help me with my work. They were doing data entry and running errands. And I thought I was an entrepreneur hiring fellow entrepreneurs. I believed the entrepreneurial ethos of the sharing economy. And then one day I had a conversation with one of my workers, Jamal, in the book, and I was asking about his experiences. And he told me about being assigned an errand to go to a local pharmacy and pick up someone's prescription. But the prescription ended up being amphetamines, which is a controlled substance. And then the woman wanted him to mail the amphetamines to China, which is illegal. And all of a sudden, I realized that the gig economy was not just about entrepreneurship, but that there was a shady underside to it, and that workers were not just about controlling their own lives, but in many cases were vulnerable to exploitation.
Don't leave us hanging. Continue.
Oh, of course. So then Jamal calls TaskRabbit, which is where he got the task from, and the TaskRabbit representative says, "Let me call you back. I'm gonna, I'll look into management. I'll find out." And he calls him back a couple of minutes later, so the phone call's not recorded, and says, "You know what? The customer's right. Sure, this violates TaskRabbit policies, but you should go ahead and do it anyway." And Jamal is a young guy. He's got a college degree in a social science from a very prestigious university. He says, "I'm not going to break the law for a $20 job. That's not okay." And so for a week, he carries around a large bottle of amphetamines in his backpack and hopes that he never gets stopped by the police. Because as he puts it, "What am I going to say? TaskRabbit's not going to defend me. I'm running an errand. I have a huge bottle of pills with some woman's name on it." And eventually, he ends up, the woman gets back in touch, and he does a handoff in a local park where he just gives the drugs to some stranger that she knows, which is also a very problematic image. And so after talking to Jamal, I realized that there was a lot more going on. And then TaskRabbit had, of course, one of its many pivots, and it became very quickly apparent that this was not about entrepreneurship and workers controlling their own lives. This was very much about workers being in dangerous positions, and that's mostly what my book focuses on.
Okay. So how did you go about your research, and what are some of the conclusions you've come to?
Two great questions. So I ended up interviewing nearly 80 workers who are predominantly millennial, but a number of my workers are actually older than 50. And I was able to recruit them through the platforms themselves. So I would go on TaskRabbit, I would put in a task, run a quick errand, and then I would talk to the individual after they ran the errand or before. I'd introduce myself and I'd explain my research, and then later on I would reach out to them if they were open to it about doing an interview and having them complete a survey. And that's what I used for pretty much all four of the services. For Airbnb, fortunately I didn't have to rent all these apartments. I used the contact a host feature and just reached out to a number of hosts. And there were two very surprising findings that came up for me. One was the idea that this is definitely not entrepreneurship for the masses. Workers are not turning to this work because they want to start small businesses. For most of them, they're trying to supplement stagnant salaries. They're trying to pay bills that seem to always be going up. They are doing this to supplement their incomes. And then the other surprising component was the level of risk that workers were experiencing. So I've talked about Jamal and how he was exposed to the risk of criminal behavior, but there are also workers who find themselves sexually propositioned through these platforms, or workers who get hit on the job, who get hurt on the job, and because they are independent contractors, they don't have any type of redress. There's no workers' comp for them. There's no insurance. And so they very much end up being vulnerable to market forces.
Well, you've opened a lot of doors, and we'll start. Your book again and how people can get it?
Sure. It's Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. And it is available at many independent bookstores, also at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and through the University of California Press website.
Okay. Now, The four again, you said JackRabbit, B&B. What are the other two?
Sure. It's TaskRabbit, Airbnb, Uber, and Kitchen Surfing, which was a sort of rent-a-chef service that actually went out of business as I was studying it. I don't think I had anything to do with that.
I'm sorry, the third one, I didn't hear clearly.
Airbnb, Uber, TaskRabbit, and then
Uber,
Kitchen
okay.
Surfing. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you did these interviews and you came to these conclusions. Well, do you have any recommendations for people who are thinking about doing this?
Yes, I do. You know, the gig economy is definitely serving a purpose. But a lot of times people believe the marketing. And so they believe that they can create their own schedules and pick their own paycheck, and it's all up to them. And so for workers who are thinking of trying to make additional money, I usually caution them that they would be much better off getting a part-time job where they are paid as a W-2 worker, or working in a gig position, but one where they are, again, classified as a W-2 worker, as an actual employee, rather than a 1099 worker or independent contractor. And that's because employees have many more protections in the United States than independent contractors. They are protected if they are injured on the job. There are protections against sexual harassment and discrimination. They, in some parts of the country, get protections in terms of sick time, and of course it's also minimum wage. And if you are an independent contractor on these platforms, you know, one of the things I say is it's very much a movement forward to the past. You are outside the protections, and in many ways you have fewer protections than your great-grandparents did when they were working.
I love that line, movement to the past. Would you repeat that? Would it explain what you mean by it? It's a wonderful line.
Thank you. So a movement forward to the past means that even though we talk about technology and we talk about disruption, how this is app-enabled work, it really is bringing us backwards by a good 100 years, more than 100 years, in terms of protections for workers. You know, the protections we have for workers in regards to sexual harassment and discrimination and on-the-job injuries, all these things were very hard-won protections. And yet, through the use of these apps, workers are very much losing those protections and going back to a workplace that's in many ways much like the workplace experienced by their great-grandparents.
You know, that's a really frightening thought, yet the gig economy, well, I think I saw that sometime in the future, 50% of all jobs will be gig-related. I've seen that figure. What do you think should be an alternative?
So I'd rather see, of course, that people's salaries get increased and that no one has to be turning to working multiple jobs. You know, about 15 years ago when George W. Bush was president, he met a woman who was working several jobs, three jobs, and he congratulated her and said that that was uniquely American. And everyone ripped him apart. They were like, that's appalling. She shouldn't have to work three jobs. And now, today, in the year 2019, what's the thing that everyone talks about? Oh, getting a side hustle, getting a second job, working in the gig economy on top of your current work. We've really just lost this idea of leisure or any type of free time, and it's all about working. So what I'd rather see is that no one has to work a second job. That said, if people feel that they really must work a second job, because sometimes that feeling does occur, then working as a W-2 employee where they are protected is a much better decision. You know, if you're a W-2 employee, you have an HR office. You have places to go. You have colleagues. You have protections. You get minimum wage at least. If you're in the gig economy, you are without any type of safety net.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've worked two or three jobs almost all my life. And I've never thought anything else about it, but just to do it. I worked my way through college with two jobs. I hear what you're saying. I'm just trying to figure out what's changed in this world that makes it so necessary.
Right. So although we do have low unemployment right now, I think the Great Recession really disrupted a lot of people's sense of security. And of course, we saw incomes dropping with the Great Recession. We saw a lot of people lost money. They ended up underwater on their mortgages. And then, although salaries are back up to pre-recession levels, the cost of living is also going up. And we see a large number of people who have exceptionally high levels of student loan debt. You know, colleges keep getting expensive. The price of buying a gallon of milk seems to always be going up. And so even though salaries are back to where they were, the cost of everything else keeps increasing. And that makes it incredibly difficult for people to really make a go of things. A large number of the individuals who are working in the gig economy are people who have other jobs, but those jobs are not paying enough, and so this is seen as a way to supplement.
You're right about that. I'm just figuring out. I was talking to a high school friend of mine, and I remember when gas was 35 cents a gallon. And now it's $2.31. Yes, I'm old enough to remember that. Milk was 55 cents. Now it's for a quart of milk, and now it's a dollar something. We seem to have changed things, but let's get back to this because we're talking about the gig economy. Where do you think it's going to go? Uber or Lyft, one of the two, is allowing its workers to participate in their IPO. I just saw that the other day. Where is everything going?
So I think we're going to see even more jobs become gig-focused jobs. You know, we're going to see a movement, and another sociologist coined this term, where we go from the career to the job to the task, where, you know, in my book I actually mention that one of the ways I knew that I had interviewed enough people was that I found a number of TaskRabbits who were actually working for the same company. There was a coffee packing company here in New York City that instead of hiring employees would just go on the TaskRabbit platform and hire a number of contract workers for the day. And that way they didn't have to worry about unemployment, they didn't have to worry about benefits, they didn't have to worry about any protections for those workers. And these workers just came in, showed up, then they filed a little review on them and they went away for the day. And I think that that becomes very appealing to companies. You know, the cost savings that corporations experience from hiring 1099 workers as opposed to W-2 employees ends up being anywhere from 20 to 40% cost savings. These workers don't have any protections. They also don't have any benefits. There's no paid time off. There's no health insurance. There's no contributions to Social Security. And so it ends up being a big cost savings, which is very desirable for companies. And so I think we will continue to see a large number of workers who are being pushed into gig work. In terms of the IPO for Lyft, if you look at the restrictions on the IPO, it's limited to individuals who've had a certain number of rides that they will get a cash bonus. But a lot of times platforms will do things like this, and workers tell me that it's very difficult for them to hit that certain number of rides. And especially since in many places Lyft is smaller than Uber, a lot of workers are actually on both platforms. And so although it sounds incredibly generous, I think it's $1,000 or even $10,000, depending on how many rides they've given, I think it'll be very few workers actually are able to participate in that bonus or purchase through the IPO.
Well, you know, right down the street from me, from my home is a main thoroughfare where every day Hispanic workers gather and they're picked up for casual work and they're paid in cash and when they finish the job. And, you know, that's the other area that seems to be, where do they fit into this picture that you're drawing, which I find fascinating?
So in my book, I divide workers into three categories. There are strugglers, strivers, and success stories. The success stories are the individuals who are actually able to create small businesses and to identify themselves as entrepreneurs in the gig economy. And these are people who come in with high levels of skill and capital. For instance, these are the individuals who have $20,000 to $30,000 in startup costs in order to rent an apartment and turn it into an Airbnb hotel. Yeah, these people are few and far between. And then most of the workers fall into the strugglers and the strivers. And the strugglers are often undocumented workers or immigrants. These are people who previously were actually sort of day laborers, or in many cases, they're very much down on their luck. They are the long-term unemployed. They've had some type of family situation or personal situation that has made them turn to the gig economy. And then the strivers are the ones that are supplementing their salaries. Usually it's somewhere else. So in terms of the day laborers that you're talking about, we actually see two things are going on. One is that it actually becomes harder for the day laborers because individuals, why would you go to the local parking lot and pick up someone that you don't know when you can just go on this platform and hire someone? And somebody who supposedly has been background checked and reviewed. And so we actually see that it becomes harder for those day laborers to get work because people are preferring the convenience of the app. And then we also see an additional component to that where we're seeing that people are going to be more likely to hire through the app. And so we might actually see that if some of those day laborers are technologically skilled and if they have the tech resources, are able to get on the app. But there's also a problem that arises with that, where we have platform dominance. You know, in my book, there's a picture of a New York City panhandler, a young guy who's sitting on the sidewalk, and he has a sign that says that he is panhandling for $30 because he has work through Uber Courier, or Uber Eats, which is their courier service, but he has to pay to activate his phone first, and he needs $30 before he can work. And so that ends up being a danger where the platforms get so much dominance that you can't work unless you can get into the platforms. And the platforms can deactivate you at a moment's notice, so it makes workers even more vulnerable.
You're sure opening my eyes. Alexandria, your book again? And how people can get it?
Sure. It's Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. And it's available at independent bookstores and also at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and through the University of California Press website.
Well, you teach at Mercer College, and you were adjunct. Now I gather you're on a tenure track?
I am very fortunate to be on a tenure track after more than a decade of adjuncting, yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that for a moment. To me, one of the most telling pictures that I've ever seen was when they were protesting down in Wall Street. Woman said, I spent $78,000 for women's studies and have a debt. And I was saying to myself, as someone else pointed out, you know, how many jobs are there in women's studies? Why did not people pick college or careers where there is so much demand, i.e. robotics, et cetera? How does that square with what you have found?
So that's an interesting question. You know, right now I'm actually doing follow-up interviews with the workers that I interviewed for my book, Hustle and Gig. And many of them are college educated, and they, in many cases, do have good liberal arts degrees. So they might have a degree in theater or in English. Some of them have degrees in biology. But for a lot of them, it became very difficult to get work after the Great Recession. You know, we saw some of the highest unemployment rates among millennials and among new college grads. And so for a lot of them, the gig economy seems like the only way. You know, if you graduated from college, like one individual that I interviewed, he graduated in 2005. And he worked for a few years in sort of entry-level jobs and was thinking he'd be able to work his way up. And then the Great Recession hit. And he wasn't able to work in his chosen field. He thought he'd be able to work in copywriting or marketing. And so he ended up turning to the gig economy. And he is still in the gig economy in 2019. I interviewed him in 2015, and he was thinking he'd be able to get out. But what ends up happening is that workers get into this work, and then it becomes very difficult to move out. How do you explain what you've been doing work-wise? You're not getting office experience. And also workers sort of face this fear of rejection. You know, at least if they're in the gig economy, they can accept a job, they can accept work as a they can accept a ride or they can accept a task, and so they don't get the same rejection of trying to put themselves out there. So I think it's maybe a little less in terms of their actual college major, and definitely ties in with sort of what the overall economy is doing. You know, some of those jobs, like women's studies, getting a degree in women's studies, can prepare you for other things. Most people don't go into the field that they have a major in, but with the gig economy, we definitely see that workers are kind of moving out of mainstream work and might find it very difficult to get back into it.
Well, but perhaps this is a loaded question because it came up recently, but it seems to me someone said there are certain categories of college degrees that you don't want to hire the person because you're hiring a radical, i.e. women's study, et cetera. And that the colleges have not trained our young people for the changing economy. What do you say to that?
So that's interesting. The economy is changing so quickly. I mean, we're talking right now about the gig economy, and these jobs didn't exist 12, 13, 15 years ago. And so what I would say is that actually what we really want to do is probably give workers the skills they need to get ahead in terms of critical thinking and being able to think quickly on their feet, and giving them strong skills in writing and in math. And that will probably serve them a lot more than particular training in something that seems trendy right now and successful but might not actually work. You know, a number of the workers that I interviewed, and I keep coming back to this because I think it's so important, are college educated. There's one individual I interviewed who has a PhD and actually was working as a visiting professor and then ends up turning to the gig economy when that work sort of dries up, and now describes himself as addicted to it because at least it's dependable and every day is different and he feels useful in that work. And he's actually in his 50s. So I think, I think that we need to prepare people with skills for the future, but we don't know what the future will bring. And so strong critical thinking skills and communication skills might be the best we can do.
Well, I'm amazed by my young people, two or three year olds who can handle electronic devices far better than I'm able to. I'm just sitting there in amazement. I can barely use my iPhone, but I just know the world is different. And I hate to end this interview because it's been fascinating. Alexandria, your book again, where they can reach it and where they can reach you.
Of course. So it's Hustling Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. And it's available at independent bookstores and also, of course, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the University of California Press website. And then my website is Alexandria J. Ravenel. So that's A-L-E-X-A-N-D-R-E-A-V-E-N-E-L. J. Ravenel, R-A-V as in Victor, E-N-E-L-L-E .com.
It's been a really interesting time, and thank you so much for being with you. A link to your website will be on Small Business Digest tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. For family, long a center of his life was unraveling. We recall his mother, Tony Soprano's mother, ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of a guest you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.